Hello, and thank you for joining us for this episode of Nation of Writers. This podcast is presented in conjunction with our new virtual exhibit, American Voices, which you can explore at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we'll discuss the life and work of Sylvia Plath, the poet, novelist, and short story writer. Plath is perhaps best known for her published collections, The Colossus and Other Poems, and Ariel, as well as the novel, The Bell Jar. Nearly 20 years after her death, Plath was awarded the Pulitzer Prize in Poetry in 1981 for the collected poems. Today we are joined by writer and educator Heather Clark. Heather is the author of three award-winning books on contemporary poetry, most recently Red Comet, The Short Life and Blazing Art of Sylvia Plath, which was a New York Times Top 10 book of 2021, a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Critics Circle Award, and the LA Times Book Prize in Biography, and a winner of the London Biographers Club's Slightly Foxed Prize for Best First Biography. She is professor of contemporary poetry at the University of Huddersfield in the UK and lives outside of New York City. Clark is interviewed by Christina Carrera, guest services and operations supervisor for the American Writers Museum.
Well, hello, Heather. Thank you for joining us today to talk about Sylvia Plath.
Thanks for having me.
Great. So, first, tell me a little bit about yourself and what you're up to now and if you have any upcoming projects.
So I am a professor of contemporary poetry at the University of Huddersfield in Yorkshire, England. Although I live outside of New York City, I have a transatlantic commute, which is interesting. Although because of the pandemic, I've been working from home most of the time. So yeah, I started my career with a book about Irish poets in Northern Ireland in the 60s and 70s and their response to the political situation in Belfast. And I followed that up with a book about Sylvia Plath and Ted Hughes, which was an academic book that focused on their mutual influence on each other's writing. And that sort of led me into the biography, Red Comet, that was published in 2020, because I wanted to write a book that I felt gave Plath a kind of her more serious scholarly due. I didn't necessarily feel like there was a biography of her that, I guess, gave her what I would call the Hermione Lee treatment.
Yes.
You know, British woman biographer, professor at Oxford, who wrote a wonderful biography of Virginia Woolf and many other women writers. And which is not to say that the previous Plath biographies, you know, are not good or whatever, but I just wanted to write something different. So, so I ended up writing 1,000 pages on Sylvia Plath.
Amazing.
And the whole kind of demythologize her and depathologize her. At the moment, I'm working on a new book about, it's a group biography of Plath, Anne Sexton, Adrienne Rich, and Maxine Cumin in Boston in the late 50s early 60s, because they all lived in Boston at that time and they all knew each other. So that's what I'm working on. And I've also begun a new biography of Anne Sexton.
That is exciting.
So a lot on the plate.
American poet as well. So
yes.
Very much looking forward to reading those two then as well.
It'll be a while, but.
Yes, great. So my first encounter with Sylvia Plath, as a very young girl, I think the two poems that stood out to me right away was Mirror and Cut. I was struck by her direct language, her imagery, the experience of being a woman. And I love the fact that I really immediately connected to these poems before I knew anything about her. That struck me and that got me into looking more about her work and her writing. Can you tell me your first encounter with Sylvia Plath?
Yeah, you know, funnily enough, it was not The Bell Jar in high school, which I know that's a novel that a lot of students read at that time. And that's often American readers' first encounter with Plath. I was backpacking in Ireland and there was a copy of Plath's journals on the communal library shelf of a youth hostel, I think down in County Kerry. And I just started reading it, and I was blown away because I had never read a woman's, I should say, I had never read a woman writer's diary before. I hadn't read Virginia Woolf's diary or Anya Snin, or, and I just was, I was so moved by this outpouring of ambition and drive and discipline, this desire to become a great writer. And also, you know, even just like female desire, all these passages about her boyfriends and this, and that. This was all new to me in the diary of a woman writer. So it just, it seemed really kind of transgressive and daring. And I just thought, wow, yeah, I gotta have to read more of Sylvia Plath. I think I had sort of fallen prey to this myth of Sylvia Plath as doomed and obsessed with death and darkness and you know, all of these cliches that we often bring to Plath's work. I started teaching Plath in graduate school. I taught tutorials on her poetry. And that's when I really, I think, became a more sophisticated reader of her work, because I had to teach it. And I was so nervous about, you know, my preparation and all this and that. I just read everything I could, all of the criticism and this and that. So that's when I just I got hooked on her work and decided that I wanted to write my second book about her.
Excellent. Great. Yes. Her journal is also a very, her collection of all her journals is also such a thick, big book, but so engaging, so interesting. It's something that I read over different times and got something completely out of it, different out of it each time I read it, each time I read different passages that she wrote. She was also such an ambitious person, as you said, and so well read in so many writing forms. Which writers do you think really influenced Sylvia Plath? And do you see that those influences come up in her writing?
Yeah, I mean, she's such a writer's writer in a way. She's so influenced by modernism, especially. She loved James Joyce and T.S. Eliot and W.B. Yeats and D.H. Lawrence. She loved Dylan Thomas. Virginia Woolf. She wrote papers about Edith Sitwell and, you know, so, and W.H. Auden. She met W.H. Auden at Smith. She worshiped these writers. I mean, she was so taken with them and wanted to read everything they wrote. And it all kind of went into her apprenticeship. Wallace Stevens as well. Marianne Moore, Elizabeth Bishop. I mean, I could go on. She also Russian writers. She wrote her Smith College thesis on Dostoevsky. And later, when she moved to Boston with Ted Hughes in 1958-59, and I'm sort of getting ahead of myself, but that's when she met Robert Lowell and Anne Sexton and Adrian Rich. And so those writers influenced her later work as well. So I really... I mean, you could just write an entire book on literary influence in Sylvia Plath, but I think, you know,
and philosophy too,
and philosophy and art. I mean, surrealist art.
Yes.
So many of those late great poems are inspired, influenced by Giorgio di Chirico, a surrealist artist. And she just had a complete command of the Western tradition. I mean, she was such a cerebral student. She graduated summa cum laude from Smith College, even after, you know, spending 6 months in McLean's hospital and a suicide attempt. And yeah, you know, I mean, she was so, so brilliant. And that's another thing I wanted to get across in this biography, was just how cerebral she was, how in command she was of the Western literary and philosophical tradition. And somebody said that someone in her Joyce class, a fellow Smith College student, said she could strip search Ulysses, you know, in 30 seconds. She could just figure out all of the references in Ulysses so easily. And she was very intimidating to other students because, you know, she's just so so good at that. And all of that informs her writing, I think, always.
Like at a drop of a hat, she could just reference.
Yeah. And even in Robert Lowell's class, he taught her at Boston University in 1959. And she was, again, according to other students who were in the class, she was the only one who could keep up with him. In sense of both of them could just find these obscure influences in poetic lines. Oh, that looks like that looks like John Donne or
definitely see her, say, like her connection or her interest in surrealism, just mm-hmm. writing more than confessional poetry that was also there, but there was also so much more as well.
Yeah. And Joyce and Yeats, I think, maybe I shouldn't even posit her favorite quote unquote writers was, but they were really near the top of the pantheon, those two.
Yes, definitely. So going into her young life, a passage that struck me in your book, Red Comet, was the conflict Plath faced in her young life to heed her calling and become a great writer in a society that discouraged women from fulfilling their artistic ambitions. How was she vulnerable, do you think, to these pressures? And how did she break free from these expectations?
Well, the 1950s was a tough time for women in general. And I try to give a sense of this in my introduction. When I quote Adlai Stevenson's speech to her Smith College class. Do you want me to just read a little bit of that?
Absolutely. Yes.
Of his speech?
Love it.
Because I don't think I can paraphrase it very well. So Adlai Stevenson was a Democratic presidential candidate and he was a liberal. So he was the Smith College 1955 commencement speaker. And so this is the title of the speech was A Purpose for Modern Women. And I'm just reading from my prologue here. The best way these brilliant graduates could contribute to their nation, Stevenson said, was to embrace, quote, the humble role of the housewife, which statistically is what most of you are going to be, whether you like the idea or not just now, and you'll like it. This assignment for you as wives and mothers has great advantages. In the first place, it is homework. You can do it in the living room with a baby in your lap, or in the kitchen with a can opener in your hands. If you're really clever, maybe you can even practice your saving arts on that unsuspecting man while he's watching television. Stevenson acknowledged what he called the sense of contraction and the lost horizons that these women would feel in their new domestic roles. Quote, once they wrote poetry, now it's the laundry list. They had hoped to play their part in the crisis of the age, but what they do is wash diapers. Stevenson hoped that his view was not too depressing, but he concluded that women never had it so good as you do. So I quoted that in my prologue because it was so shocking to me, and especially because this is coming from a liberal darling, a liberal Democratic candidate. And it just, I think, sure. In a very short amount of time gives you that sense that women's professional and artistic ambitions at this time just were not taken seriously, and they were really not encouraged. And Plath, you ask how she was sort of vulnerable to some of these conformist pressures of the 1950s. I mean, yeah, absolutely. In one way, she was really a conformist. You see it in her hairstyle, in the way she dressed. She had this veneer of Seven Sisters. Propriety and respectability. And many, many people, friends who knew her, when I asked them about her at that time, they would always mention that, the way that she dressed and presented herself. And she seemed very bourgeois and quote unquote respectable. And she wanted to get married and have children. And, she wasn't living any kind, she wasn't like a bohemian in the 1950s. She was outwardly, but I think inwardly she was this secret iconoclast because she did rebel. Just even this, she wanted to pursue these intellectual heights and to become this great writer, which even that was unusual and not encouraged at that time. And she, she had a literary vocation and she honored that always. She broke off informal engagements with two men who her mother wanted her to marry. One was a doctor in training, and a Yale man, an Amherst man, and she just didn't think that they would take her writing seriously. I mean, there were other issues there, but one of them she wrote about in The Bell Jar, the man based who inspired the character of Buddy Willard. But I think when she met Ted Hughes in England, she felt like, you know, well, he was, somebody who was an iconoclast, and she felt like he would respect her writing and her calling and her vocation. And he did. So I think in that sense, she was, she did try to break free, and she was kind of rebelling against all that. And of course, it all comes out in The Bell Jar.
Yeah, it's definitely her crisis and disillusionment that she experienced in that New York internship that supposedly promised her the beginning of her career, ended up being exactly the opposite of that and even more confining. I mean, she really didn't get to experience the city of New York and all it had to offer. They were just pulled back into this confining place, focusing on shallow pursuits, and that was it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I mean, it's based on events that really happened, but it was so brilliant of her to set part of this book within this world of the beauty industry. And, yeah. You know, these impossible standards that women were supposed to adhere to, and the objectification and all of that. I mean, I think the novel, I think of it as a protest novel, protesting the mental health practices of the era, protesting women's repression during the Eisenhower era. So I think, again, like that's where another place where we really see Plath, the iconoclast, Plath, the feminist, break through in that novel.
Yes, definitely. And I think it is a strong example that she did speak up for the disenfranchised and for dissidents. And her writing was pretty revolutionary and also socially aware, not just in The Bell Jar, but also as well comes out in her other poems as well.
Yeah. And I think that there was this idea that Plath was not socially aware. She wasn't political, and you used to read that. I think that's changing. There was a book published a few years ago about Plath and the Cold War by a scholar named Robin Peel. And that really, for me anyway, it showed how political she was. And I think, you know, again, I think The Bell Jar is such a political novel. The politics of that are hiding in plain sight. The first sentence of the novel is about the execution of the Rosenbergs. and there's this idea throughout the novel of dissidents, right? The sure. Rosenbergs are executed in the very beginning for their nonconformity. I mean, obviously they were executed for alleged espionage, but I think Plath connects that to her heroine's dissidents too. And then, and you know, her heroine goes through a kind of electrocution with the electroshock treatment and all that. So she's really connecting those two themes in The Bell Jar, and which I think is a very political move on her part. So yeah, it's The Bell Jar. I almost feel like it's a kind of quest narrative, you know, like will she get through it? And when you finish it, you sort of wonder, well, wait, Was Esther sick, or did her society make her sick? And I think Plath wants us to ask that question by the end of that novel, because, you know, Esther lives in a pretty sick society in some ways.
Yeah, and I think it still stands to time right now that it's relevant in women breaking from conformity and pushing against that. One memory also that I have from when I was reading Sylvia Plath young, I remember a teacher telling me as I was reading her work, and very seriously, he looked at me and he said, "Beware of Plath." And of course, that made me want to read her even
more. Oh, of course, right.
Anything about her.
Yeah.
But there is, I mean, besides the obvious of why. Beware of Plath, it'll make you
beware, I rise with my red hair and I eat
yes.
my hair.
Those lines as well. Yeah. And I'm like, this is great.
Yeah.
And so she is sort of dangerous in a way. And I think as well in how she pursued her art and her writing, she did seek out the danger element and breaching the edge of what she could for a creative breakthrough. I find her that really amazing as well.
Yeah. Yeah, she was brave. I mean, absolutely. And I think she sacrificed so much for her writing and her, you know, she always put her writing first to the detriment of I think her own physical and mental health sometimes. You know, she was so hard on herself just in terms of how productive she needed to be and you know, and to achieve, I think, what she wanted to do, she had to work twice as hard to become a great writer in that era as a woman. She did have advantages, obviously. I mean, she was white she went to Smith College, although she went on a scholarship. She did not come from a wealthy family. She had to work really hard to keep those scholarships throughout those years. But you know, she had to fight for it. And I think you see it in the Bell Jar as well. And you see it in the poetry, just this constant fighting and pushing and bravery, as you mentioned.
What ways do you think Sylvia Plath transformed literature?
I think there's sort of poetry before Ariel and poetry after Ariel. And I think, you know, she has this voice that's so singular and arresting and this crystalline imagery. And there's such control and authority in the verse, such attention to poetic form, and also such strangeness, I think, that keeps us coming back and reading these poems over and over again. I think her poems are actually really difficult. I'm a little surprised that she's so popular, because there's a lot of just obscurity in the poems. You really have to read them over and over again and to keep up with her. And she's moving the goalposts, I think, technically and formally. She's a master of poetic technique. She could write villanelles and sestinas with her eyes closed by the time she was 17 years old. Actually, I should say she was writing in perfect iambic meter when she was 8 and 9. I mean, she's like this poetic protege, and she did have a genius IQ. So I think, I think Ariel was such a watershed book because this voice was so original and people hadn't seen that before. And she introduces female anger, I think, into the poetic lexicon, female rage, especially within an elegy, which is so revolutionary. And she's one of the first poets to write about motherhood and women's experiences and miscarriage and postpartum depression. You know, she's really pioneering that way. Anne Stevenson, who is the late Anne Stevenson, poet and Plath biographer, she said that Plath was one of the first great poets of childbirth in the language. And I think that's really important and maybe not acknowledged as much as it should be, just, you know, how she really helped. I mean, she was just such an innovative poet. And I think she did open up poetry in a sense of what a poem could look like and could be. It didn't necessarily have to be ornate and rhyming every other line perfectly, although she loved rhyme, but you know, it could be looser, but still keep that core musical integrity. But she also introduces new themes into American poetry. So I think both in terms of her style and her substance, she was really innovative.
Yeah, definitely think it's enduring that she wrote about things that women didn't speak about.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this was a time when the word pregnant was not uttered on television in America. And here she is, she gave a talk. I shouldn't say a talk. She read her poem, Parliament Hill Fields, on the BBC, and it was about miscarriage. So, you know, this was not something that you spoke about on the BBC in the early 60s. And she gave a little introduction to the poem that kind of, you know, made it clear what it was about in case anyone was wondered. So yeah, 1960, 1961, this was really revolutionary and brave. Again, I go back to that word.
Absolutely. So going back as an American writer and American experiences, you delve deeply into Plath's background, Sylvia Plath's background, and how How did her family's history, including their American immigrant experience, how do you think that influenced her writing and her approach to her art?
Well, she was brought up in a, you know, an immigrant family milieu. Her father was her father had immigrated from Prussia when he was 15. He spoke Polish and German. And he learned English really quickly. He was a brilliant man. He ended up getting a PhD at Harvard and becoming a professor at Boston University. Her mother was also brilliant. She was the daughter of Austrian immigrants. So I think Plath, you know, she grew up feeling different from her WASP peers in that way. Especially during the Second World War, when to be German was really could be dangerous, right? There were Germans who were lynched during that time. So, and she wrote a short story about this called The Shadow. So I think that, you know, that German identity was something that she wrestled with her whole life. And you see it in her later poems like Daddy and Lady Lazarus and all of her controversial Nazi imagery and Holocaust imagery. But I think she always, I think, felt like she had to prove her Americanness. And her mother did too. Her mother had a strong feeling like that. Her mother had been bullied as a child during the First World War. Her father had been investigated by the FBI during the First World War because of his German background. So there was always this sense of almost like persecution in a way. And she almost worried that members of her family could be sent to a detention camp for Germans during the Second World War in America. So there was this desire to prove one's Americanness, like one's fealty to the American dream and this and that. And so I think you get that sense from her adolescent journals that she's this golden American girl who does, you know, she goes to Girl Scouts in the afternoon and she wears her, you know, just the way that she dresses, and her patriotism is all over her journal and how wonderful it is to be American. Yes. it's almost jingoistic. When you read these unpublished journals, you kind of chuckle to yourself, but it was real. And I think it was very powerful, a very powerful identity that she held onto. Now, when she moved to England, things started to change. And that's when she became more, I think, critical of America and started to write some poems that reassessed some of our ideals. And so I think once she left the country and was looking back, you know, things started to change a bit.
Definitely, yeah. And as I'm mentioning, as an expat American writer in England, there are significant conditions and relationships that drove her work, changed it, impacted her writing style.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my short answer to that would be Ted Hughes. He was so important in that sense, culturally. I mean, also as a literary partner, but he was the one who convinced her to move back to England in 1959. Just a little quick chronology. Plath met Hughes in 1956 at a party at Cambridge University. They married in June of 1956 on Bloomsday, which is, you know, of course, the day that Ulysses was set, and they wanted that Joycean connection, their wedding day. And then they ended up moving back to America. Plath taught at Smith College for the 1957-58 year. Hughes taught at the University of Massachusetts for some of that time. And then they decided to ditch teaching. They decided they wanted to make it as, they decided they would try to make it as freelance writers in Boston. So they moved to Boston, 1958, 59. This is where Plath meets Robert Lowell and Anne Sexton in this legendary creative writing class. But Hughes was not happy living in America. And I think really missed England and was very critical of America, very critical. And some of this you hear and I think influenced Plath's view of America as well. He just thought it was so commercialized and materialistic and in some ways was quite horrified by it, although he was in love with its natural beauty. So they moved back to England in late 1959. And part of the reason they moved was, you know, obviously Hughes was more comfortable in England, but also the BBC was an institution that they felt could offer them a way out of teaching because they thought they'd be able to get commissions from the BBC, and the BBC paid really well. America didn't have anything like the BBC. And so that was, they thought that was something that they looked at as a kind of lifeline to their dream of living without having to teach, you know, just working on their writing. And also England had free healthcare. So, and Plath writes about this quite a bit, like that they wouldn't have, it would all be free. Yes. And they save a lot of money, and which, you know, obviously was true. So, I mean, she and Ted Hughes had a lot of connections to the BBC, and Plath benefited from those. So I think that that helped her in terms of raising her profile in England. And Hughes was the most famous young poet in London around the time they moved back. His book, The Hawk and the Rain, was just a huge success critically. They were having dinner with T.S. Eliot when they moved back to London. And I think in Boston, Anne Sexton had been kind of the more favored poet in Robert Lowell's class. But when, you know, when they moved back to England, Hughes is sort of feted everywhere. And I write about what that meant for Plath in my book. It was kind of a double-edged, you know, situation, but she benefited from it, obviously. And she met, you know, a lot of British poets who were important to her, British critics. And she wrote in her journal at one time, she said, "My tempo is British." And she sort of felt like the Brits maybe got her better, like they got her dark wit. And but you know, then she would say something the next day about how much she missed America. she would go back and forth quite a bit. One of my PhD students is actually writing her whole PhD on Plath's transatlanticism, like her dual cultural immersion in England and America. It's a fascinating topic.
And she was also, though, in such heavy academic and literary circles. And as an American, she was kind of judged for being an American writer and having an American education. There seemed to be also a lot for her to prove there, but it also challenged her a lot more.
Yeah. And I, you know, I think it was hard for her coming from Smith College, which was such a nurturing women's college, and to then be kind of thrust into Cambridge, which was an all-male university with a few small women's colleges. And Plath was at Newnham College, Cambridge, but women were second-class citizens there at that time. I mean, no doubt about it. And I think that was really hard for her. She hadn't quite realized just how difficult it would be to kind of break into the literary culture at Cambridge. And so Ted Hughes, in a way, appeared at just the right moment, because he and his friends were doing something different. They had started this literary magazine that was kind of supposed to be against the grain, kind of in rebellion from some of the current styles of poetry that were popular at that time. Like Hughes and his friends, they wanted to write more like Yeats and Dylan Thomas and Robert Graves and D.H. Lawrence, and they were kind of wilder in that way, and she was really attracted to that. So she was drawn to Hughes really for his poetry before she even met him. She read his poetry and she kind of, you know, fell in love with the poems first.
Definitely, absolutely. And they both definitely created something new in writing and in poetry. Can you give me an example of a poem that demonstrates this, Plath's mastery of the literary tradition, but also where she really created something new?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard to sort of choose just one. I write in the biography quite a bit about Daddy, which is one of her most controversial poems. It's probably her most best known poem, her best known poem, although I don't think it's her best poem. But that I have this sort of pet theory that she's riffing off T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland.
Sure.
In that poem, there's a lot of thematic overlaps, but she's also with these really short lines and exclamation points and nursery rhyme cadences. It's almost like she's trying to demolish the moral authority of that Western literary tradition that T.S. Eliot embodies. So I think it's a very ironic poem in that way. And I would also say, you know, The Bell Jar, I think, again, is a kind of rewriting, riffing off of Joyce's A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. But again, it's this ironic coming of age novel. It's this ironic working of Joyce from a female perspective. And, you know, where Stephen kind of lights out for the territory at the end of Portrait of the Artist, and he's going to use silence, exile, and cunning. And it's this really romantic ending. You know, Esther tries to commit suicide. I mean, I just think that Plath was so aware of that book as a kind of template. And of course, Joyce is a huge presence in Esther's life because she's trying to write a thesis on James Joyce in The Bell Jar, and that sort of precipitates her breakdown. So I think that there are so many ways in which Plath is talking back to Joyce in that book. But just in terms of introducing, like we were talking before about women and women's experiences and that sort of thing, I would point to Three Women, her verse drama, which is I think it's one of the best things she ever wrote. And it's longer, so it maybe doesn't get as much attention, or it's not anthologized as much, but it's about three mothers. It's about a mother who gives birth to a healthy baby, one who has a miscarriage, and one who gives her baby up for adoption. And she just sort of gets into the minds of these women. And the stanzas are sort of very neat. They're seven line stanzas throughout. And she's really adhering to very traditional form, but she's doing something that's not traditional within this traditional form. And it was sort of inspired by a 1958 Ingmar Bergman movie. But I think I sort of see Three Women as sort of her first real kind of feminist stand.
Excellent. So thinking of terms of now, how do you think Sylvia Plath would be engaging in our current world?
Well, this is something that came up in some of the interviews I did with friends of hers. I guess I'll just mention two responses. One of her friends from high school, who knew her very well in Wellesley, and he talked a lot about how he thought she would have become a really passionate Democrat right now, that she would have been kind of, I'm not sure, I don't know that I would go so far as to say she would have been progressive, but he was fairly certain she would have been a Democrat, and she was even at the time. I mean, she was, they were writing letter, they published an article in the Christian Science Monitor, kind of questioning Cold War hawkish rhetoric and that sort of thing. And she was a pacifist. And so she was already kind of on her way. She shunned McCarthy. And then a friend from her later years in England, who eventually became a kind of environmental activist, she told me, she said, you know, I think Sylvia would have been walking beside me in all of these marches. And the sense seems to be that, you know, she would have been kind of horrified by what's happening. But I think she would have been political. She wouldn't have just, I don't know, ignored it all.
Absolutely. Why do you think people should still read Sylvia Plath today?
I think people should read her for the beauty of her words, for the originality of her vision. I mean, setting aside her life story, just, you know, the poetry it's second to none, really. I mean, I think it's some of the best poetry written in the 20th century. You don't need to know anything about Sylvia Plath's life to appreciate the technical prowess and the musicality and the kind of shocking uncanniness in some of these lines that lines that just stay with you forever. It's, she's just a true original, and it's, her poems are, you know, they just keep you coming back over and over. They really reward multiple rereadings. And people complain to me quite a bit that poetry today, oh, I can't get into poetry. It's just like chop prose. Sure. People say that all the time to me. And I'm a, you know, I'm a poetry professor, so I feel like part of my job is to advocate for poetry. But Sylvia Plath was not a poet who wrote like that. You know, she did not write in chopped prose. And every, even in the poems that seem like they're just free verse and that they're they're about to fly off the page, she's always got some secret form underneath, undergirding these stanzas, whether it's rhyme or meter or a stanza length. You know, she's always playing with forms in these really ingenious ways.
Do you have a quote or a stanza or a poem that you like to hear that you really connect with and enjoy?
I think that, let me see my Plath book here. So, I mean, my favorite Plath poems are actually some of the quote unquote darkest ones. I don't actually see them as being dark because I think that they're about depression and I don't think we should stigmatize that. And I actually think that she was someone who described that state of mind so lucidly and beautifully, actually. But I guess I won't read it. You know what? I'll read a poem that I think is underappreciated, called Morning Song. And this is about motherhood. And I'll just read it. She wrote it in February of 1961. Morning Song. Love set you going like a fat gold watch. The midwife slapped your foot soles and your bald cry took its place among the elements. Our voices echo, magnifying your arrival. New statue. In a drafty museum, your nakedness shadows our safety. We stand round blankly as walls. I'm no more your mother than the cloud that distills a mirror to reflect its own slow effacement at the wind's hand. All night, your moth breath flickers among the flat pink roses. I wake to listen. A far sea moves in my ear. One cry and I stumble from bed, cow heavy and floral in my Victorian nightgown. Your mouth opens clean as a cat's. The window square whitens and swallows its dull stars. And now you try your handful of notes. The clear vowels rise like balloons. So I love this poem because, well, first of all, there aren't that many poems about this phenomenon of, you know, having to wake in the middle of the night and feed your infant, which, you know, is really exhausting, but wonderful. So it's a tribute to that. But also, I love that it doesn't sentimentalize motherhood. It's a warm and loving poem. Love set you going like a fat gold watch. I mean, what a memorable first line. But then there are also these stanzas that reflect this sort of existential angst. You know, I'm no more your mother than the cloud that distills a mirror to reflect its own slow effacement at the wind's hand. My God, what a stanza. And I think about that stanza a lot. And the ambiguity in that. And I just, yeah, I love that she doesn't sentimentalize this state and that, you know, motherhood is really hard. I stumble cow heavy in my Victorian floral nightcap.
A great image.
Yeah. And so I think an underappreciated Plath poem. So I just wanted to give it a little bit of love there.
Thank you. That's beautiful. Thank you. Well, where do you see Sylvia Plath's literary lineage in today's world? And are there any contemporary writers you can tell have been influenced by her in any way?
Yeah, this comes up often, this question. a friend of mine named Sarah Corbett, who's a lecturer in a professor over in England, she is putting together a Sylvia Plath Festival in October of next year.
Oh, wow.
It's a huge celebration.
That sounds exciting.
Yeah. It'll be around Plath's birthday, late October. And she said recently that the reason she tried to put this festival together was because she's a poet. And she said, you know, so many of the poets that I am friends with, especially women poets, we all credit Plath so much for showing us the way and inspiring us. And she said, this is such a frequent topic of discussion amongst us, but we felt like it wasn't getting enough attention of just, you know, how crucial she was for us as poets in inspiring us. So that was part of her reasoning for putting this festival together. I think in terms of more well-known poets that she influenced, I think of people like the late Irish poet Evan Boland, whose collection Night Feed is very Plathian. It's a lot of poems about motherhood, a lot of poems in the first person. I think she inspires women poets especially to write in a quote unquote more confessional vein. Adrienne Rich, you know, I think sure. Even her writing is influenced by Plath, and Sexton. Sexton influenced Plath, I think, first, but then the influence went the other way too. There was a lot of back and forth there. Sharon Olds, Maeve McGuckian, even, you know, Seamus Heaney, whether his famous bog poems are influenced by Plath's Lady Lazarus, you know, maybe. I've heard talk of that. And then the poet Paul Muldoon is actually giving a lecture at my university in a couple of weeks about Plath and Hughes's influence on his own poetry. So this is something I think that extends to many different poets, men and women, American, British, Irish, European. I mean, all she has a really international reach.
Yes. I mean, her themes were very far reaching as well, and her writing style as well. Well, those are all the questions I have for today. Thank you for taking the time to talk about Sylvia Plath.
Thank you for having me. And I just wanted to mention that I think Plath would be so honored to be a part of the American Writers Museum.
Yes, definitely. We definitely
would just love, she would love being included in this.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. If you'd like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, find us online or come see us in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.